Hi there, it's Marcus from Four Eyes.
Morning, Sean speaking.
Sector work group. We're going to wait a few more minutes for folks to show up, and then there's a obligatory antitrust statement that I'm going to have to read, and then we can kick off our meeting. So sit tight for a few minutes and looking forward.
Rose, are you there? It's John.
Hi, John. Could you hear me? I was just talking. Were you able to hear me?
Yep.
Okay, yeah. Great. You're here. I thought you might not be here.
I'm here. I'm here because the ferry that I'm supposed to be on got canceled due to a mechanical failure, but Stephen's going to do the presentation for us.
Oh, I'm sorry about your ferry.
Silent life, I guess.
I know. Well, if I could think of silver lining, I would insert it here, but I'm not sure what that would be. But I'm glad
we
you're
just
here.
Wait for the next one.
Silver lining is you're here. Okay. That's great.
We'll just listen in, and you guys are in great hands with Stephen.
Excellent. Okay. Well, we're looking forward to you chiming in, and I'm sure it'll be very helpful. Well, I'm still sorry about your ferry. We're going to wait a couple more minutes until about 2 past the hour, and then I'll read the antitrust slide, and then we can hop into everything. But glad you're joining us.
You know, John does a really good job at reading that.
we share on the
And reading the antitrust side. I was hoping love somebody else to read this. It's something I feel like somebody else could do a better job. Or if there's any volunteers to be the slide reader, please let me know.
Hi, Bobby. Very good morning. This is Kiran Murthy from Auroblox, just logging into this call for the first time. Was introduced to it by Bobby at a local New Jersey meetup the other day. Hello, everyone.
I'm glad you joined us. The call's just about getting ready to start.
Oh, hi, Bobby. Very good morning. Sure. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Hi. This is Rose. Oops, who's that?
Oh, good morning. This is Daniela Barbosa with Hyperledger.
Oh, hi, Daniela. Great to have you joining.
Thank you.
This is Rose Schumann, the chair of the group. I was about to kick things off, but if anybody wants to say anything before I kick things off, actually, we're not really supposed to talk yet until I kick things off with this antitrust slide. So how about I just jump into it? Other than, again, opening the call that if anybody else would like to be the reader of the antitrust slide in the future, this is an open position. Okay. Antitrust policy notice. Linux Foundation meetings involve participation by industry competitors, and it is the intention of the Linux Foundation to conduct all of its activities in accordance with applicable antitrust and competition laws. It is therefore extremely important that attendees adhere to meeting agendas and be aware of and not participate in any activities that are prohibited under applicable U.S., state, federal, or foreign antitrust and competition laws. Examples of types of actions that are prohibited at Linux Foundation meetings and in connection with Linux Foundation activities are described in the Linux Foundation antitrust policy available at www.linuxfoundation.org/antitrust-policy. If you have questions about these matters, please contact your company counsel, or if you are a member of the Linux Foundation, feel free to contact Andrew Updegrove of the firm Gesmer Updegrove, LLP, which provides legal counsel to the Linux Foundation. And with that exciting opening, We are now ready and able to formally kick off our meeting. So hello, everybody, and excited to see all of you here. Looks like we have a great crop of participants today. I've sent around an agenda as a suggestion of how we can run the call today. But first, I'll quickly tell you what the top highlights of the agenda are, and then think it'd be great if everyone could quickly go around and introduce themselves just so we know who's here. The way we're looking at running the meeting today, which runs an hour, is first to have an open chat, following up on Kumar's question at the end of the day last call, which was, when doing a proof of concept, how do you handle getting information from existing systems as well as the mechanics of actually replacing that system? So how do we do succession between very different systems, moving things over to a Hyperledger-based system? So I think that would be quite an interesting open discussion. After that, we're gonna have a great presentation from Bobby Muscar of Ledger Academy, who's going to give a high-level overview of the different Hyperledger frameworks out there. After that, we'll go into John, and actually now it's going to be Steve, who's going to tell us a bit about how Hyperledger Indy actually works. So one of the things we determined was that many people in the group would really appreciate an in-depth primer on the various frameworks and tools of Hyperledger. So we're going to aim to have one of these every call or almost every call until we work them through, so everyone's better informed by the end of the year. We have updates on the Hyperledger Global Forum, and then opening the floor to other topics. And again, encouraging anyone who's got questions or could use some peer support or would like to share a project that they're thinking about or working on, that this would be a great time to make that known so that we can schedule that in and send some attention to it. So without further ado, if folks who would like to introduce themselves could please do so, go ahead. Welcome.
Hi, Marcus from Flies. I have a blockchain consultancy and development company.
Bobby, Ledger Academy.
Ken White from the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston.
Scott Schneider with Information Builders.
Marta Pekarska from Hyperledger.
Hi everyone, good morning. This is Kiran Murthy from Oroblox. We are a blockchain consulting company and an Oracle partner. Our interest is understanding what's going on in the Hyperledger fabric. And this is my first call, thanks to Bobby. We met at a meetup a day or two ago, and she brought up this meetup that happens on the federal space. So this is our first call. I'm excited and thanks for joining.
Good morning, everyone. This is Pete Tigan with IBM.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. This is Roman Anderson. I'm with Solid Armor, and I'm also the organizer of NJ-Blockchain, which is based out of mostly Newark. We do programs. Thank you.
This is Rain DeVivo. I'm an attorney in Illinois. I worked for the state of Illinois in a number of different areas, mostly in Medicaid. And then I've also represented municipalities in private practice. So I'm just interested to learn more about how blockchain can fit in with government.
Hi, this is, I'll introduce myself because others joined in. This is Daniela Barbosa with Hyperledger. I'm part of the staff team here at Hyperledger.
Would anyone else like to introduce themselves?
I'm going to be talking a bunch later, but I'm Steve Curran, work with John Jordan at BC Government, British Columbia.
Great to have you, Stephen. Thanks for taking the reins on that. Anyone else want to jump in and say who you are? You don't have to, but this is the best time to do so. Okay. Well, then we're going to presume everyone who's wanted to introduce themselves has, and a warm welcome to everyone who is both introduced and not introduced themselves. Looks like we're going to have a great group of people and a good discussion. Before we get into the agenda, if anybody would like to propose any changes to the agenda or additions, this would be a good moment to chime in now. Otherwise, we'll just go as programmed and have that open space at the end of the call to go over miscellaneous issues. So if there's anything you'd like to see changed or add or suggest, this would be a good moment. Okay, great. So let's jump into Kumar's question, which was just an open discussion format on when doing a proof of concept, how do you handle getting information from existing systems as well as the mechanics of actually replacing that system? So it's really looking at two phases here. It seems that I think for many people, there's either limited or only theoretical experience about how this transition might take place. And I think a hunger and interest in hearing anyone's experience on how they handled that process from either a technical or operational or even human interaction type of perspective. So has anybody here had any experience doing this, and perhaps what's maybe one or two key learnings that they had over the course of it that they didn't know at the outset?
So this is Ken, and I can tell you what we've been trying, and we're getting closer to connecting it to, you call it the mainstream network here. For the time being, we've got several Hyperledger Fabric proof of concepts running, but most of them are either air-gapped or tightly locked down at this point, and we're pushing towards getting the platform mainstreamed here in the environment, and we're getting closer. And then once we get to that point, we have an internal platform as a service offering that we'll be able to really start to exploit it. But for the time being, we've been struggling a little bit here with getting the technology installed so it can see other things. We've had great success with air gapping it, but as far as mainstreaming it, that's, you know, it hasn't taken hold yet. So it's kind of a little journey description about where we are.
Thanks for sharing that, Ken. Does anybody have any questions for him about their experience or want more detail on his context? I would like more detail on the context, actually. How Ken, did this project actually get initiated? What was the driver?
So we've got a working for the Federal Reserve System. We've got a vested interest in what does blockchain technology mean for the financial services sector. So we really need to understand it, and with respect to, you know, bank-to-bank transactions and, you know, what are the capabilities. One of the other things that we're looking at is one of our roles is an advisor to our member banks. So we can go out and advise as to what, you know, the individual banks should be looking at and policies and things like that. So not necessarily regulator, because we're not necessarily a regulator, but how can we advise our member banks to do things? So it's, you know, there's a lot more as well as why we're interested in blockchain technology. And we've had some good success, you know, getting a much, much better understanding. We also are, you know, active in our community, and we've hosted a meetup here as well. To that and share some things. We're developing a white paper, which will let you know when it's available, with our journey. That's got much more detail as to what we've been doing. So.
That's fantastic. I really encourage others to ask Ken some questions, but while you all are thinking about it, and when do you think this white paper might be ready? Because it would.
We're shooting for Q4. We've gone through the process right now. We're folks up on the executive level providing feedback and things. So we're hoping in the October timeframe, October, November.
That's great. I hope that you'd be willing to present it to the group here, if it wouldn't be too much of a burden on you, because I'm sure it would be very interesting and fascinating to learn about that experience.
We would love to.
That's great. Great. This is a fantastic example. Is there anybody else who would like to chime in with their own experience? Again, it doesn't have to be a perfectly formed or very advanced experience, but anything at any part of the process, even if it's preliminary, about what you've encountered when doing a proof of concept in terms of getting information from existing systems or actually doing replacement. Is there anything that you've encountered that might be valuable learning for others or surprised you? This is an open question to everyone.
Rose, this is Pete Tuggan. And I think challenging the premise of that question altogether, the replacement of legacy systems, is something worth talking about or considering. In our perspective, of course, depending on the scenario or the situation, we don't necessarily look at it as a replacement of a legacy system as much as a supplement to. So really, you know, when you're building a blockchain POC on top of an existing process, trying to improve a process, you know, we start with the POCs just doing API calls to whatever that underlying legacy system, the data store, of each of the network members, and pulling that up into the blockchain network. So I wouldn't look at it as much as a replacement of a legacy system as much as a supplement to.
That's a very interesting comment and learning, Pete. Would anybody else like to ask Pete a bit about this position or their experience, or contrast it with their own experience or corroborate?
Yeah, this is Kiran Muthi from Aurablox. I'm not sure if it's going to be strictly Hyperledger, but I'll tell you some experience from what we've been working on for the past few months. Thanks to the team at Hyperledger. Martha, I think, knows about it. There was an RFI that was sent or put out back in the day for record management, and there's an exercise that was put together where we joined the party as well and said, how do we respond to an RFI showcasing blockchain as an enabling technology for interagency collaboration? So that's an exercise we've done with Hyperledger. On top of it, we've fielded other conversation in the federal space, predominantly around collaboration from interagency systems. So the technicality of it boils down to this, right? So there's two aspects of communicating with the consortium, inside out, outside in. Inside out, we think triggers is the way to go, or rather events, as people say it. There's also an intermediate layer that we can introduce via the concept of oracles and oracles as in oracles in the blockchain ecosystem. But from outside in, people talking about pushing data from legacy systems onto the chain itself. I think I would concur with what Pete was talking about. I mean, Hyperledger Fabric itself, and we being an Oracle partner, they are exposed API, REST, endpoints, and JSON is the standard payload that have been very enabling for us. So if you're sitting in an enterprise architecture ecosystem, there's a microservice that you have exposed internally that is authenticated, accurate, and certified to transact. And there's that layer put together. I think pushing data onto the ledger itself from sitting inside a legacy system is not a big deal at all. But again, this is not going to be a snapshot where you take a million rows in the traditional systems and transfer system to system using a tool or an EDI or an ETL or so on and so forth. So getting data from legacy systems seamlessly onto the ledger, I think the practicality of it is pretty seamless. The scalability side of it is something that we can all say that we got mileage to cover. So that's, I mean, and we've done at least 3-4 conversations wise, but more predominantly, it's possible. It's not going to be as scalable as you would want to at this point, but I think that design pattern is well articulated. I'm strictly speaking, since this is a Hyperledger conversation about Hyperledger's side of things, and on the Oracle side of it that we are partnered with, and there's a REST API that makes it a little bit easier, but that's about it. So I hope this helps to a certain extent.
Thanks, Kieran. Oops, I'm hearing somebody back, but first, thanks so much, Kieran, for this very practical inputs on your experience. I'm going to open it up to one more comment, but then being mindful of time, we're going to move to the rest of our agenda and perhaps pick this conversation up again, because it looks like it's getting a lot of activity. But I feel like, is there somebody else who's trying to chime in now?
Absolutely.
Oops, whoever's talking, you're very, very quiet. You're still very, very quiet.
I think it sounds like somebody's having a side conversation.
Okay, because I'm like, this is okay. I think you're probably right, Pete. Thank you. Okay, so this has been a really excellent conversation. I think we're ready to move on to Bobby, who has an excellent presentation to give people an overview of frameworks. So without further ado, Bobby, you ready to take it away?
Hi, everybody. I'm just going to share my screen, give you a little preface as to what this is. This is a PowerPoint presentation that goes over the frameworks and the tools under the Hyperledger products. We're going to go over the frameworks today, and I'm going to briefly just touch on them. But this presentation is also going to serve as something I hope that will be stored on our wiki as a resource for the people in the group if they ever have to give the presentation. So I've added notes at the bottom with little dates and stuff that you might want to add if you're giving the presentation. But basically, let's see if I can share my screen. And here we go. Everybody got that now?
Yes, we see.
Okay, so we're basically on the agenda page because I'm not sure which screen you're seeing. Again, this is the agenda. We're going to go over the presentation goes over the Linux Foundation and Hyperledger, and then the frameworks. And then next week, we're going to touch a little bit on the tools. And eventually, also stored in here will be brief overviews of use cases that we've gone over. So again, you can resource them when you resource this presentation. So again, the Linux Foundation just goes over the nonprofit. And then there's a link there to the projects. These are some of the projects that the Linux Foundation hosts on a broad sense. But this presentation obviously is about the Hyperledger project.
Sorry, this is Rose. We see both Hyperledger, but then we see your next animation. So we're seeing not
okay.
A full screen. Perhaps you can pop it bigger. Still small. We see two.
How about that?
That's big. Thank you. Great.
Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. So again, Hyperledger is the fastest growing project in Linux history. I'll go over this quickly because this is just information for the presentation. It talks a little bit about how it's the shared truth, gets trust in there, open source, and it's a global collaboration. Again, here we go for the actual Hyperledger
frameworks. There's Burrow, Fabric, Indy, Roha, and Sawtooth. Again, if it's yellow, they're in incubation. If it's green, they're actually moved out of incubation and active projects. So these go over a little bit about what each one is identified as. And then again, we go into the tools, which we'll go over next week. So I'll do that very quickly. Again, this is Hyperledger Fabric. It's a high-performance permission blockchain foundation developing application and solutions in a modular framework approach. Its features are plug-and-play components for consensus mechanisms and membership services. It has a smart contract piece, which is called chain codes, and it's the logic component of the system. These chain codes can run inside secure Docker containers. So it leverages that Docker technology so it can host any mainstream language for the smart contract development. And then there's a list of a little bit of what each one of the segments of the product is written in. Again, some channels, those are the features that lets different participants involved only see the transactions that are relevant to their individual transaction. The channels are private sub-networks of communication between two or more network participants, peers, or nodes for private transactions. There are roles each node that gets clearly defined at the setup of the Fabric application, and they're committing peers, endorsing peers, and ordering peers. And again, if you want more information on Fabric, I set a link at the bottom for the most current documentation coming out of the training and education workgroup. Moving on, we're going to go to Sawtooth. And Sawtooth is a blockchain designed for versatility and scalability. So it supports both permissioned and permissionless deployments. In doing so, it recognizes diversified blockchain requirements. It includes a new consensus algorithm called Proof of Elapsed Time, or POET, and its aim is to achieve distributed consensus as efficiently as possible. So it targets, again, a large distributed validator population, but they try to use minimum resource consumption in their consensus. It does this by using the secure enclave that is built into the Intel chip for a random wait timer. So each of the validators get on the network, and the validator whose timer expires first generates the block. So it doesn't use that electricity like in other blockchains. With the tool Burrow attached, can support this application for writing on the virtual, on the EVM, and the smart contracts can go on right on the virtual machine. Again, the key characteristics, the pluggable census algorithms, the new consensus proof of elapsed time, the ability to write smart contracts in almost any language. It supports Burrow and the integration of the Ethereum machine. It's a great example for supply chain out-of-the-box solutions. And it has parallel transaction execution for additional throughput. And again, I left a link for the current Sawtooth documentation. Moving on, we're going to go to Burrow. And Burrow is a modular blockchain that was built, again, to work with the EVM. It's licensed. It uses a Byzantine fault-tolerant permission ledger and Tendermint consensus, which is, again, working with the EVM. It provides an account model and an internal token to meter the consumption and the permission settings. For transaction finality. So those things are in there forever. And again, Tendermint is the consensus mechanism. Its goal is to be compliant and friendly towards integrators. So it's trying to do a little interoperability. It's going to be fast, light, and lean. And it's to provide, you know, again, a practical base for extensions for a multi-chain world. It is not trying to be like Sawtooth or Fabric, highly pluggable or hard to deploy. Again, the documentation can be found at that link. The last one that I'm really going to go over is Roha. And again, it's distributed for mobile application and mobile development. And it's written in C++. Its aim is to get reusable components so that users can perform common functions transferring digital assets. So it uses pre-built commands that are already in the system. So no need to write your own code and test your smart contracts. It's already been done, so it's faster and less risky. It's, you know, added to different projects that are already fostering robust libraries. So it's basically a library's plug and play. So you can get some of the Hyperledger technology into different projects. It supports JavaScript libraries, and it's working for both Android and iOS operating systems design kits. Here, again, are some key characteristics. Simple deployment, libraries, role-based access control, modular design, and assets and identity management. It uses a new consensus algorithm called Sumeragi. It's permissioned network. It's written in C++ and Java chain code. And there's special libraries. And again, the documentation for Aroha can be found at that link. And finally, very quickly, the last one is Indy, and all I'm going to say about it is that it provides digital identity rooted on the blockchain so individuals can own their own information and only share pieces of it. So we're going to go over Indy in a presentation next. So thank you very much for listening to me. And again, I will get with Kumar to get this up on our wiki library so that you can access this. Thank you for letting me discuss this with you.
Thanks so much, Bobby. This is awesome and really helpful consolidated overview. And thanks to both you and, of course, Kumar for getting the wiki in really great shape so everyone can peruse this on their own time and really absorb all these characteristics as well as resources. But this is fantastic. And we're looking forward to your next presentation on our next call, which will go into the tools. But thanks so much, Bobby. This is great.
No problem.
Awesome. Okay. So after this really very useful overview, we're going to go a bit more into Hyperledger Indy. So I believe, Steve, you're going to go into that. Also, just before you start, Steve, do you have a sense of your target time length for this, just so I can direct traffic properly?
Yeah, I was just thinking that same thing. I was thinking like, 15 minutes maybe. Is that too much?
No, that's actually perfect. 15 is great. Okay. So let's aim for that and take it away then.
All right, I'm gonna share my screen.
Thanks.
Because I too, of course, have to have a presentation. Because it's much easier to talk to. So, and this is a Google spreadsheet or Google slide. So you can take a look at it and people can look at it after. There's some links in it and so on. So introduction to Hyperledger Indy. So we've been using Hyperledger Indy and BC Gov for about a year and a bit now. Today could be launch day. We go live in the next few days with our first production application. And I think John Jordan talked about that in the last week or something like that on this call any previously. So, little bit about what I'm going to talk to. So I wanted to start with, you know, sort of grounding the problem of what is, the identity problem. So I'll just summarize a little bit from that. I think everyone's aware of it. I'll just focus on what Indy attempts to, deal with in that. It really is about trust. It's about who it is we're talking about when we're online. The famous New Yorker cartoon captures it well. You don't know who you're talking to. And as well, can you trust what they tell us? And the fact that people can type in and say, you know, what is your social security number? And you can type a number in really doesn't give you any ability to reduce the risk. Or doesn't sufficiently reduce the risk that you can actually conduct an online transaction based on that information. And it turns out it's a really hard problem. We've been trying to fix, people have been trying to deal with this for 30 years on the internet. And we're still not all the way there. And we think Indy can take it an awful long way to actually fixing the problem. So, the information that's the basis of that are lots of identifiers. So user IDs and passwords are everywhere. You've got your government ID that they issue, your email organization gives you an address or your organization gives you an email address, all of those are substitutes for who we are when we're talking online. But as well, not only do we want to know that ID and be able to prove that, you know, you're the person behind the ID, there's all sorts of attributes about us that we need to know to be able to do online things. Know your customer and things like that, for just the ability to present that you represent a company. For example, we're focused on company space, and who are you, or do you have permission from the organization that you represent to actually conduct a transaction? On paper, it works fairly well. There's known patterns. Basically, a holder has some sort of piece of paper, a passport, a driver's license, a permit, and they use them to show somebody, and they look at that and they say, yeah, that's real. So that proves you have that authority to act. Online, as somebody told me yesterday, just two transactions work: advertising, which uses us as the product, and shoes, which is because we physically ship it somewhere, we can trust that, you know, they're going to give us a good credit card and we can trace them down if they don't. Other than that, we haven't really accomplished a lot online of beyond advertising and selling. I'll skip by the encryption, but basically we've got some encryption that allows us to have conversations, have, you know, web sessions that are encrypted so we can safely transmit, for example, credit card numbers and things like that. But it's actually one-sided, and I'll skip by that for now. Ramifications, these are things you'll all recognize. Passwords, I have over 700 passwords in my LastPass account. We try to fix that by having identity providers provide our identity. So we have login through Google and login through Facebook. And then they share a little bit about you with whoever site you're logging into. But it really is siloed and not in our control. Correlation is a huge issue. If you haven't read about this Xactus data breach, worth looking up, there's a link here. They had a big data breach, which was a big problem, 340 million identities. I found the more fascinating thing about that data breach was they had basically 400 data attributes about every person that they were selling to anyone that would buy it, that basically had things like, you know, your name, your email address, typical things like that. But they'd also, through correlating your data with all sorts of websites, had, you know, religion, where you lived, how many kids you had, race, sex, you know, all of that information. They had just collected through backdoor approaches to aggregating your profile and then providing it to others so they could target their advertising. So identity theft, and then attributes. Attributes are susceptible to theft: social security number, you know, your passwords and things like that. But as well, even offline, in-person proofs are becoming problematic, and more people are looking at the in-person proofs and saying, you know, those are forged documents. Those are becoming harder to make secure. When I go to a bank, for instance, they ask for prove my address by giving them a utility bill that would take me at least 12 seconds in Photoshop to create a substitute. I probably wouldn't even need to use Photoshop. I could use PowerPoint. So Hyperledger Indy, how does it deal with this? So that's the introduction to it. First, it starts with decentralized identity. So instead of a central authority giving you an identifier, you create your own identifier, and you provide. And there are mechanisms. Hyperledger Indy is one to resolve those identifiers. So this thing I've got up here, did:solve, and a number. That's what a did looks like, a decentralized identifier. So they're obviously random. They're ugly, not easy to deal with. Next, that identifier has associated data with it, public keys, and you control the private key associated with a DID that you create. and a service endpoint, a way that someone who has that DID and has that DID document, the associated data with the DID, can find you and connect with you. Those DIDs are exchanged between identities, even consumers in business. So they become peers. So when you exchange a DID, you create one and your peer creates one. You both exchange, and now you both have a public key to talk to one another. So that's that gives some pretty powerful capabilities. And we'll talk about those. But each identify has a different DID for each relationship. So it gets rid of this correlation capability. So when I set up a relationship with my bank, I create a DID. When I set up a relationship with my spouse for online discussions, I set up a DID. And they're all different. And they all look kind of ugly and the same. So basically, that means that each organization that I connect with can't use that piece of data and exchange it with another company and then correlate that data between us. End-to-end encrypted messaging. And by this, it does include IMs and notifications, and it could include email, but it also includes other types of transactions when we say messaging. But basically what this says is if I have a DID, I can resolve that DID. That gives me a public key that person owns and an endpoint. And so that I can send a message encrypted, and the only person that can decrypt it is the owner of that DID. And that's pretty powerful. Again, email addresses are the number one method of correlation. You have to register your email address so they can contact you. But that's, of course, your number one connection across all these services. That's the correlation factor. So decentralized identifiers, that's the cornerstone number one. Decentralized gives you a key that there's a blockchain involved. So some DIDs, and we'll talk about that in a bit, are published on the blockchain. So because they're published on the blockchain, basically you create a DID that gives you that identifier. You create the public key associated with it. You have an endpoint somehow, and we'll talk a bit about that. And then you publish that to a blockchain, and now it's on this immutable place that you've published. And when people get that DID, that magical identifier that you've created, they can resolve it by looking it up on the blockchain, and they can connect with you. And so Indy has a blockchain implementation. It's called Indy Node in the public ledger part, and it creates a decentralized key management system. So basically, for those who know anything about PKI, that's a centralized one. Distributed means that a decentralized one is just a safe way of distributing public keys that can be reused. And there's actually not supposed to be a question mark around here. The question mark is that they tried various methods over the past to create it. DKMS and what enabled by Hyperledger Indy and a couple of other open source identity systems really create that first method. For those familiar with Fabric and a couple of others, those are private permissioned blockchains. Indy is designed to be a public blockchain, so it's available in the public space, but it's permissioned. Only certain people can write to it, and we'll talk a bit about how that gets controlled. But basically, unlike Bitcoin and Ethereum, you cannot just start up a node and write to the blockchain or create blocks on the blockchain. You have to be permissioned to do that. That allows for a very efficient block creation and consensus algorithms and things like that. So it uses pretty fast capabilities for writing. The third cornerstone, agents and wallets. So I'll go over this quickly, but basically to manage DIDs and things like that, obviously you need a bunch of software. The DIDs are big and ugly, and you have thousands of them as a consumer. You would have thousands of them. So you need software running on a phone often. You need a wallet, which is where your keys and some other data get stored. And I keep referencing other data. You'll see that in a bit. But that secure data, that's got to be locked down and held securely. And that is one of the challenges of getting this out, is making sure that we come back with both a secure way of implementing a mobile app, for example, or a desktop app, but that combines usability with the security you need of having a wallet that contains keys that you need to control. Basically, this is sort of the picture of the generic world. You have an edge agent, which is something like a phone. You talk to a cloud agent. It talks to the DID layer of the blockchain piece, and that allows you to talk to other identity owners. Could be enterprises in this case, and people on the other side. Could be whoever you want to talk to. The Indy SDK is the core of agents, and there's a whole raft of people, including us, working hard at coming up with the protocols that allow agents, arbitrarily created agents, to talk to one another. So that's a big area of progress right now in the indie world. Now, the last piece is really the magic that really lets it, this technology is really important to this technology, and that's verifiable credentials. So verifiable credentials, and you'll sometimes hear the term verifiable claims, is a W3C standard based on a working group that allows for the exchange of those same sort of paper documents that you've got in the paper world, but done in a digital form. So data about you is issued by somebody. They give you the credential that you hold. And then every once in a while, you need to show that to somebody to prove something. And so you hand that to another verifier to show that you indeed have that information. Underlying all that is this, is the blockchain, is Indy and the identity registry. So the model is the same as you're familiar with walking into a bank and showing them a piece of paper that proves something about you. But in this case, we're doing it digitally, and we're doing it in the same way, though. The issuer provides it to you as the holder, and when you want to, as the holder, you give it to a verifier. So what does it mean to say proven? I said that in this picture that I can hand this to a verifier, and it proves certain things. So what are those proofs? What does that prove? So this is where the magic cryptography comes in. So I won't say a whole lot about that, but there is, this is all handled by the cryptography underneath and the keys associated with the bids and things like that are going forward. So what I can prove is who issued the claim. So if I have a claim that is a driver's license, claims that are from a credential driver's license, the issuer is the government entity that issues driver's license. I can prove that that was the issuer. And I don't have to ask the issuer that. So that's that very key, crucial part. I'm not actually asking the issuer to prove that. Just the holder proving this and giving it to the verifier proves that. The claims were issued to you. So because of some data embedded within the credential, you can actually prove that the issuer issued the claim to you, and you're now proving that you are in control of the proof of ownership of that data associated with the claims. You can prove the claims have not been tampered with. That's fairly easy in cryptography world. There's a signature on it, and of course, if you change any of the data, that's going to break the signature. And finally, this is the addition that you really can't do with paper at all, which is you can actually do real-time proof of non-revocation. So you can prove that the credential that was issued by the issuer has not subsequently been revoked. So again, pretty powerful stuff. The last thing that is the caveat is exercise for the verifier. Who issued it? Note that I said that you know who the DID of the issuer. So you can use the blockchain to trace back who that verifier is. But you still want to decide, do I trust them? And so this comes back to, for example, your transcripts. You can have transcripts that are issued to you and that show that you are, you have a degree. But do you trust who that issuer was? Who the issuer is of those transcripts? Is it Harvard University or is it 2-Bit University that sells them on the internet, sells transcripts and sells degrees on the internet? So it is an exercise to the verifier to figure out who issued that credential and whether you trust them. But it does take that to a different level. So instead of saying, do I trust the person who's giving me this? Did they forge that or whatever? You actually know they did not forge it. They couldn't have forged it. It was issued to them. There's no question of that. The question is, who do you trust that person that issued them? And that's where a lot of these credentials will come from people you do trust. There's a couple of magic pieces that Indy adds that are pretty cool, which is selective disclosure and zero knowledge proof. So the two things those are when you get a credential, you don't have to present the entire credential. You can just present the information that's relevant to the transaction you're trying to do. So you can block off these things and you can at a bar just say, this was issued by BC, this is my picture, and I'm over 19. And zero knowledge proof is that last bit, over 19. So without exposing my date of birth, I can prove that I'm older than a certain age. These are the ramifications, and probably, I think this is where I wrap up, but you hold your data and you share it as necessary via proof. So you don't have others holding it for you and sharing it on your behalf. You actually hold the data and you distribute it when you want to. Security become harder to forge than paper credentials. Over time, as this gets accepted, simple data, strings of data become useless. You can have a form today that says enter your SSN and you have no idea whether the person that their SSN or just a number that they bought off the dark web, as they call it, that is your SSN. If you have to prove you have an SSN issued by the US government, that's a different question. All sorts of online transactions becomes possible because you're able to prove things necessary to conduct that online. Last thing I always want to talk about on Indy, it is a public blockchain. There is no private data on the blockchain. So there is the DIDs. There's some data around the verifiable credential that enables us to share and do cryptography on the credential that you've been given, but there is absolutely no private data. The credentials themselves are not, they are given to you and stored in your wallet. They are not put on the blockchain. So that's incredibly important. This is a detail that I probably don't need to discuss. And then the last thing to talk about is the Sovereign Foundation is very tied to Indy because the Sovereign Foundation is a nonprofit that is operating a global deployment of Hyperledger Indy. So this is the foundation that drives the actual implementation that will probably be used. So it's a BLT, a business and legal and technical framework that outlines how it can be used, what the role of the node operators are called stewards. So I remember I said that they are permission. So stewards are the people that are permission to create blocks and reach consensus on blocks. There's about 40 of those in all sorts of industries and across the world right now, and that will grow significantly over time. So Sovereign Foundation operates an instance of Hyperledger Indy across the globe and provides the structure for infusing trust into this permissioned blockchain. And we always have Mary who's trying to run a bakery, and so she can do best because we've taken care of her identity and fixed the internet for her. And that's that. And I'd probably talk a lot longer than 15 minutes. I'm sorry.
That's okay, Steve. This is Rose. This was great. Okay, doing some traffic direction here. I know that many people are probably going to want to ask you questions and also show appreciation for this terrific presentation. It would be great if you could share the link to your presentation. Yep, through the email list or the chat so that Kumar might be able to put it up on the wiki. So thank you, Kumar. Before we get into questions, it would be great if everyone considers their questions and notes them, but we're going to jump forward so we cover our agenda before end of time to Marta, who is going to give us an update on the Global Forum. And apologies, Marta, for the compressed time, but I'm sure that we'll all be fine. Over.
Thank you, Rose, and I'm sorry for the background noise. So we have submitted a panel proposal for the Hyperledger Global Forum. This was a discussion about privacy and governments. We've had scheduled to have three panelists and Rose moderating the panel. However, due to the fact that we had a lot of submissions that were quite similar, and actually panelists who decided that or submitted their talks to Hyperledger Global Forum, so that agreed to be on the panel, also submitted their own talks to Hyperledger Global Forum. And in order to accommodate as many people as possible, in fact, I think we hit something like 10% of submissions were only accepted because of the amount of submissions and high quality of them. So we had to be very selective. So due to all of that, we have decided to create a panel that will talk on blockchain. So all the people that were scheduled to give a talk will have a slot, I believe, at the Global Forum, and they have been notified. However, they were notified separately, not officially our panel was rejected. But participants that wanted to give a talk at Global Forum will have a slot. I hope that makes sense.
Thanks, Marta, for the overview. Would anybody here like to ask some more questions and get clarification? Okay.
Yeah, so this is Kieran from Auroblox. I just have a quick question. A great presentation, Steve. The question is, in your implementation today that you're talking about going live, the entity that is going live, are they running a dedicated node on the Sovereign Foundation themselves, or are they leveraging the public infrastructure that's been run by, as you said, 40 other participants?
So we're doing a two-part live. We're publishing, so we're going live on our own instance for the next couple of weeks while we work everything out, and then we will go live on the Sovereign instance. We don't run a node. We're considering becoming a steward, the BC Gov is, but not particularly crucial. We're comfortable with how Sovereign is running it, so we would use theirs to operate the node, or to operate as the blockchain backing for our launch.
Okay, great, thank you. And the second question is, in your integrated development exercise that you've done internally, unlike the public side of things where there's the testnet and the mainnet and all kinds of stuff out there, what kind of infrastructure have you leveraged to see the things that are working the way you see them or intend to see them working in on the public side of things? Created?
So it's really easy just to spin up your own network for testing and things like that. So we've spun up, so most development work is done just with a local instance, but then we've spun up a couple of more available instances as well that we make available to others to use. And then there's also a Sovereign test network. So there's a range of places you can run applications that use different ledgers. Ultimately, you want to obviously have to be on one ledger to have a production system, and we would use the Sovereign. We would always use, I think, Sovereign public network.
Great, excellent. That's exactly what I was hoping to hear. Thank you very much. So, does the governing entity itself, from an MBC perspective, do they have an intention? Because now that they're putting their entire demographics to be identified on the DID side of things, on the Sovereign side, are they taking any measures to make sure the sustainability of the Sovereign network itself? I know you said eventually you might cut your own blocks, run your own node, but at this point you're leveraging the public side of things. But having investments made at that integral level, does the governing authority or the government itself see a need for running their own infrastructure to support the larger network?
At this point, no. As I say, there are a number of entities in Canada as well as globally that are running nodes, so we're feeling good about that. There's also a couple of other networks that are building up with the same sort of idea. So as a government, we just want to enable what we find that meets the privacy standards and the identity standards of the government. So there's Privacy by Design, and there's an organization that has an identity trust framework in Canada. And as long as those entities meet that, and of course, we'll look at sustainability and so on. Sovereign looks good to us now, but it's early days. So it's exciting times to figure that out.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Hey, everyone. This is Rose here interjecting that we're getting some really great momentum around Q&A. Noting the time that we're at the hour, those who would like to stay on and continue to talk, we can do that. But let's do just a little bit of preparation for our next call so that we have something equally interesting and engaging. Would anybody be interested or in a position to give an overview of another tool or framework for Hyperledger for 2 weeks' time from now? While you're thinking about that, would anybody like to share some thoughts they're having about a project they're working on or considering, or a problem they'd like to work through, or pose a question to the group that we can discuss? All right, yes? I see Marvin, are you trying to say a comment?
Oh, I am. My question was more about distributed storage as it relates to this ID. Is there any thought to do a distributed storage of that blockchain to, in case like one of the blocks got attacked or something, or are you gonna all have it just sitting on their infrastructure or containerized or anything of that nature?
Okay, I think that would be a terrific question to just to give a sense of how it might run since we're at the end of our time. Martin, would you be willing to write that question as a sentence in the chat and use that as part of our agenda for 2 weeks' time as an organizing discussion question? Would that be possible?
Yes, I can do the Zoom. I can put it in the Zoom. That's not a problem.
Okay, if you wouldn't mind either emailing it or putting it in the chat, then we will use that as a discussion for 2 weeks. I see here also from Marcus that you could show Hyperledger Composer or Explorer. I think that would be fantastic. Marcus, perhaps you could pick the one that you would like to showcase the most, and we could lead off with that. Unless the crowd here has a strong preference for Composer versus Explorer for 2 weeks' time?
Well, the Explorer, I have one question.
Yes, Marcus?
The Explorer is quite basic and quickly shown, so I think I can make something within a short time frame which demonstrate both of the tools.
Okay, fantastic. That would be excellent. Thank you, Marcus, for volunteering to share information to everyone about that. All right. So we have a question from Marvin, who much appreciated for you to just type that up in a sentence. And Marcus. Okay. Does anybody have a project either that's in the middle of being launched or that's being conceptualized or some questions that they're trying to think through that they would be willing to share with the group? It could be real, it could be hypothetical. Okay, well, we'll leave that as an open opportunity, but we have a presentation for next week, and we also have Bobby, who's gonna go over the tools. So I think we'll have a pretty good schedule shaping together, so thanks everyone. Let's just go back to questions. I don't know, Stephen, how much time you have.
As much as you need.
Cool. Okay. So let's just open this up the floor to anyone who'd like to discuss the Indie presentation or anything else that's relevant.
Hi, Stephen. This is Marcus. Thank you for your Indie presentation. It's quite interesting. I was wondering how you solved like the issue of the wallet and the usability. Because when people start to use like services on the browser, you always have this issue of how to handle the keys.
So that it is a challenging piece. So there is sort of layers of keys involved with wallets. There's been a lot of work done. So the main driver of how that's being handled is based on work that DHS in the US funded, that a company named Evernym has done. So there's a paper basically called about DKMS itself, which covers things like backup and recovery. But the idea is largely where it's likely to go is sort of what's called social recovery, where you can basically split a recovery key, share it amongst a group of people or companies, and together that would allow the recreation, the recovery of a lost wallet and things like that. But it's not absolutely not a slam dunk thing yet. That's going to take some work, and that's where that agent work that I talked about is going, and we're pushing a lot in that area because what from a BC Gov perspective, we want to see interoperability and things that we can recommend our citizens use and our organizations use. And that's got to be a big piece of it. Not easy, but we think there's some really good things coming out of it.
And if I want to use this service you're about to deploy, how does this look to me in terms of user interface? Do you have a regular like login and password and some key management behind that? Or do I actually
Ours is so we're starting with public data so that there's not a risk. We want it to be safe in doing this. So our production is based on public data. So there's actually ways to log in or not log in, just access the site and browse it. John went over, I think, the theory of the project we're working on. So it's a bootstrap for a two-sided market. But you can just log in or not even log in. You can just access the site once it's live.
Thank you.
Does anyone else have any more questions for any of the presenters today? Okay, Well, it seems that we've covered at least the first round of questions on the presentations. And again, many thanks to Stephen as well as Bobby and also Marta for the update, as well as Marvin, who we're looking forward to please typing up your question in one sentence and sharing either through the Rocket Chat or the email so that we can use that as part of our agenda for next week. But this has been a good discussion. Thanks also, Ken, for sharing your experience as well in the informal discussion. But I think we've learned a lot and had a really productive session. So many thanks to everybody. If anyone would like to send any feedback or add anything to the agenda for 2 weeks' time from now, please just get in touch. But again, many thanks to everyone's participation and really looking forward to the next one in 2 weeks. So thank you, everyone, and wishing you a very nice weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.